Hello everyone and welcome to our podcast. My name is Tom Wagenmakers.
And my name is Julia Meyer.
And today our guest is Dr. Francesco Giumelli. He's an associate professor in international relations and international organization. And his expertise is in international sanctions, EU foreign policy and illicit trade. One of his latest articles is a study on the implementation of sanctions in the European Union. So he's the perfect guest for today's topic, the effectiveness of EU sanctions against Russia in light of the renewed invasion of 2022. Welcome, Francesco, and thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Yeah, let's start with the first question, right? I was thinking as an introduction to this episode and also to this topic, because I think sanctions are sometimes a bit complicated. Could you try to shortly explain to us the different types of sanctions that exist, right? Because we know that there are sanctions on imports, on exports, sanctions on people. So which type of sanctions exist? Could you show this to us?
Sure. This is one of the questions that I've been answering most oftenly in the past months, because of course sanctions now became a topic that everybody's acquainted with because of the Russia situation. But of course sanctions have been around for a long time. So what we talk about when we talk about sanctions mostly is something that was established as a practice in the international system since the late 90s, early 2000s, which is what we call targeted sanctions. So while you read the newspaper and you hear about sanctions on Russia, what you normally have is sanctions on individuals. Individuals, specific sectors, specific economic products. So this is the kind of sanctions we're talking about. The sanctions that we've seen in the 90s with Iraq, a total embargo on a country, these are not type of sanctions that we see very often. So the first important thing that we need to know about sanctions is that sanctions are very often targeted on individuals, sectors of the economies, companies, or potentially involved people in sanctions traded goods. So let's say that you might have a company that has not been trading in dual-use technologies or semiconductors, but they might become, and then even if they are not mentioned in the list, whoever is selling the goods, whoever is processing the payments, they are supposed to be knowing. So again, it's a sanction on companies, it's a sanction on individuals. And then we talk about different types, indeed, as you said, Tom. So we talk about sanctions on trade. So we have goods, things. Think about raw materials, or think about also processed goods. We have a set of sanctions imposed not only on goods, but on the intention of what are you going to be doing with those goods, what we call the dual-use goods. So goods that can be used for both civilian and military objectives. And then we have sanctions on the financial sector. And the financial sector can be either sanctions on assets, financial assets, or ban on payments, ban on loans. So a bank is forbidden for giving and granting loans to others, credit lines. Insurance services is another type of sanctions that we've been seeing very often. So, for instance, in the case of Iran, the case of Russia, one of the bans that was most, and it is most effective, is forbidding insurance companies from giving insurance services to oil tankers. Because an oil tanker is a big boat with a lot of oil. And if it sinks, then the damages of an environmental damage are very high. So no oil tanker would ever sail without a big insurance, to the point that they don't need an insurance. The insurance of the oil tanker needs an insurance. So that's what's called a reinsurance market. And that's also what the European Union and the US have been doing a lot. Then we have sanctions on individuals. Sanctions on individuals of the type, for instance, a travel ban. So you're forbidden to enter from entering to a country. Visas, for instance, these type of restrictions are also there. And then the classic is also the arms embargo. So the prohibition of selling weapons or any related material that would be used for either repression of demonstrations or for, as in the case of Russia, for instance, for actually a military operation. So this is, in a nutshell, the kind of sanctions that we have. So to sum up, sanctions on individuals, companies and sectors are mostly now used. And we have sanctions on export, so goods, import also, sanctions on financial products and sanctions on individuals and weapons.
All right. So first of all, again, thank you very much for joining us, also from my side. You already mentioned earlier when you started explaining what sanctions are and what types there are, you already mentioned that sanctions have obviously become quite a topic in the past few months and in the past year. So could you walk us through which sanctions have been applied to Russia since the renewed invasion of 2022?
Well, this is a question that would take a long time to go into details. I can say two things. The first is that this is the first time that so many sanctions have been applied to such a big player of the global economy. So all individual sanctions were actually already applied, from the most invasive ones, like the freezing of the reserves of the Central Bank of Russia, the over 300 billion in denominated in euro and dollars, sanctioning the heads of state. That's also something that has been done before, but not in case in a case of such a big player of the international system. Russia might not have a very large economy. Well, I'll rephrase it. Russia has a large economy. They might not have an economy the size of China or the size of the US, but they're certainly top 15 economies of the world. And this means it's a very big one. So when we talked about the beginning of the sanctions, at the beginning of the war, there were people saying, well, Russia has a small economy. That's the size of Spain. Well, Spain is a large economy of the world. So, and the different thing between Russia and Spain, that Russia is more integrated in a number of global value chains. When it comes to raw materials, Russia is there. When it comes to oil and gas, Russia is very present. We think about, you know, going after oil and gas, but uranium comes from Russia, gold comes from Russia. So there are a number of parts of whatever that we reprocess in China or in Europe or in the US, they used to come from Russia. Food comes from Russia. And then whatever is produced in Russia can also be important for food production elsewhere. So the real uniqueness of this case is not the set of sanctions that we've been imposing in the last 12 months, but it's certainly the number of sanctions on such a big player of the global economy. So that's the first important thing to say. Why do I say this? I say this because you might have been reading in the news very often that this set of sanctions is unprecedented. And I wanted to clarify that it is not it's the combination that is unprecedented. And the fact that sanctions were not very harsh is demonstrated by the fact that, for instance, the European Union has imposed 10 packages of sanctions. If sanctions were very harsh, then you wouldn't need 10 packages. You would need only one or two. So the fact that there's been a build-up now in 12 months, almost every month, going beyond the original package of sanctions, and then it means that sanctions could have been expanded. Now, the overview of all sanctions measures on Russia is definitely very long. I will point out a couple of things that are more important. So first, I will go randomly, so not in order of importance. So the number of individuals that we have listed is so broad that creates a lot of confusions in all the parties that need to work with Russia. So think about the bank. So sanctions go normally in the sense that a number of people are not supposed to be getting payments, and also people directly and indirectly related to them. How do you know if you are a bank, if you are ING, if you are BNP Paribas, how do you know who is indirectly related to someone? So the confusion and the number of both individuals but also products list is so high that it's very difficult for these companies to process payments or also to actually carry out the export, which means that the impact of sanction is actually broader on Russia, because the confusion creates what in war we call the fog of war. We can call it the fog of sanctions. So private companies are not really sure what to do. So there are a number of people and a number of products listed that create a lot of confusion. There is the freezing of the central bank reserves. So it's over 300 billion that has been now frozen since February 2022. And this is going to be an interesting question. What happens with that money? In the past, in other cases, Libya, Iran, there was a confiscation of that money. That is state-owned money. Now, there is also a discussion on the freezing of assets of private individuals. That's another set of sanctions on those over 1,000 people. And that is also something that we will have to discuss, and it's very invasive. So all the so-called oligarchs and what's going to happen with the resources, whatever we manage to freeze, it's going to be a different story than the reserves. But indeed, this package of sanctions on the oligarchs is also impactful. We have seen sanctions imposed on the top government officials. This is normally not happening, because what you want to do, you always want to talk to the president or the foreign minister. In this case, both of them are on the sanctions list. So, and this is not unique. North Korea has been, you know, had this, Sudan had this, Venezuela had this. So this is not new. But yet, this is Russia. It's much bigger than these other parties. And then who is talking to Putin? Who is talking to Lavrov? This is an important part of the story. There is the whole section on specific high-end products, so the so-called semiconductors. And the idea is to make sure that this kind of equipment does not get to Russia, especially for the military instruments. So the idea is if you manage to undermine the production of certain products, the military might of Russia is then weaker. That does not mean that they will not produce anything. It means that the quality of the action is going to be more impaired. And then there is one other set of sanctions that is especially visible from the 8th package onwards, is the idea of going after whoever is helping in sanctions evasion, the circumvention of sanctions. This is also something that for the European Union it's new, for the US it's not. But the idea is to add to the list all those actors, anywhere they are, that are demonstrated to be helping companies in Europe and in Russia to carry out trade that would be otherwise prohibited by the sanctions package. So this is, again, a very short overview. The way in which sanctions work is at the very micro level. So what you have the code of a product being banned. So there are now hundreds, if not thousands, of codes being banned or being subjected to export license, which means you need to ask the national competent authorities of your own government whether you can export, the authorization to export a certain product. And that's also part of the story. A lot of goods that now we're talking about, we've seen going, cell phones, they are not forbidden. You can sell and you can buy them from Russia and from Russian parties. But then the problem is from where, how can you do the payments? And then who decides what you can sell? Very often these products need to have a license for export. So they can. It is allowed, but they have an extra check. So again, this is in a nutshell, the overview of sanctions that we have had on the Russian Federation since February 2022.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think that's a very, very clear overview. I liked what you said about the fact that the sanctions build up. And if we compare that to, for example, after the annexation of Crimea in 2014, the EU imposed sanctions on Russia as well at that time, right? And I remember that that was kind of presented as an effective foreign policy, right? But obviously, in hindsight, I would say, well, these sanctions didn't give Crimea back, right? And it didn't prevent them from the invasion. So how are these sanctions a step up compared to those sanctions? Were they too light or what's up with that?
Sure. This is a very important question because the comparison between 2014 and 2022, especially for the Russian case, comes very obviously to mind. They were very different scenarios. So the fact that you have sanctions in 2014 and sanctions in 2022, that does not mean that you have two equally important or equally heavy sanctions. They are fundamentally different. The sanctions in 2014 were very light compared to today. The sanctions now are really way more impactful and broader, and they involve more products. And politically, they go again, as I said, to the president and the foreign minister. In 2014, there was nothing of this kind. In 2014, there was a set of measures very restricted to weapons, very restricted to certain territories in Ukraine and in Crimea, which are, again, still there, by the way. So these are two different regimes. And especially you have, in between March and July, a couple of rounds of sanctions. Very few people are involved, very few products, very few payments. There is credit lines are involved, but not disconnection from SWIFT, for instance. That's something that happened in 2022. And then as of September 2014, there was not this build-up. So basically, sanctions remained at the same level from 2014 up until 2022. So there was not really the build-up that we've seen now in the last 12 months. So they are qualitatively and quantitatively different, the sanctions that we've imposed in 2014 and in 2022. And when it comes to the effectiveness, it's a little bit the story of the glass half full or half empty. Because those who say the glass is half empty would say exactly what you said, Tom. Basically, Crimea is still under control of Russia, and Russia came back in 2022. The others would say that, listen, sanctions allowed or postponed something that was supposed to happen already in 2014. It was sanctions that determined that, you know, a change of policy in the Russian Federation, in the Kremlin, that what they wanted to do could not have been done in 2014. If you look at what Russia has done in between 2014 and 2022, it really looks like that they were planning for this. They built what it has been called now as the war chest or the sanctions chest. The idea of making sure that even if sanctions were coming, then the Russian Federation was going to be able to hold the pressure from this.
They created this MIR, this credit card system that was disconnected from SWIFT, right? And especially to anticipate a possible disconnection from SWIFT so that they would survive in that.
Yeah, the MIR, the reserves were, they started to invest in Chinese currency, divesting from US dollars. So what it seems that from the dynamics is that they were not believing that the Europeans were going to do this because they still held a lot of reserves in euro, way more than in dollars. And why did they do this? If you look at from 2014 to 2017, they had a lot of US dollars. And all of a sudden, they sold all of these, and then they started to get euros and Chinese currency. And then now, of course, a lot of reserves have been frozen because they were denominated in euro. And the question is, you know, the bet that you can read from far is that they thought that the Europeans were not going to do this. Maybe the Americans, but not the Europeans. So again, that was a bet. You can see that there was a war chest. And why do you have a war chest? It's because you're planning for something. And in 2014, you were not ready. So someone could say that sanctions actually helped to stop what happened there. And then I want to add a second point. Very often we have a narrative where sanctions are supposed to solve everything. So as you said, sanctions did not remove Russia from Crimea, did not return Crimea to Ukraine. But is it what sanctions are supposed to be doing? Is it sanctions alone? Maybe you have diplomacy that didn't work out. Maybe you have a poor way of using the military instrument. Maybe you have a very poor way of using the economic tool in a positive sense. We're very often quickly jumping to conclusions when it comes to sanctions effectiveness, but we don't use the same criterion to judge and assess everything else. Sanctions never work in isolation. It's always part of a bigger story. And in the case of 2014, you can say the sanctions helped. Did they solve everything? No. But then anybody can say, did the military aid that we're giving to Ukraine solve the situation? And everybody will say no at this stage. So again, it's always a combination. It's always a mix. So what we need to learn is we need to identify what are the different instruments achieving within the mix. And that is not necessarily directly connected to the overall foreign policy objective of a strategy, but sanctions did help in that moment to send a strong signal in 2014 to the Russian Federation, say, listen, we are serious about this, so the Donbass is not supposed to be touched. That's a signal that we did not send with Crimea, and that's one important build-up within the crisis in 2014 that is not often very appreciated.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. I think the point that you made about Russia anticipating this conflict is a really good one. And what you said also leads quite nicely into the next question, which is usually we are inclined to say the economy is hurting, so sanctions must work. However, when we look at countries such as North Korea, which you also mentioned earlier, we see that countries can actually endure quite a lot if they're willing to do so and if they're sort of preparing for it beforehand. So in that sense, there is also a distinction between purely punitive sanctions and sanctions that are employed with an incentive to produce a change in behavior. How can we measure the effectiveness of sanctions? So you already mentioned a little bit about that, but could you elaborate some more on how there are tools or specific ways to do so?
Sure. This is also one other question that I get very often because, of course, the effectiveness of sanctions is also what I've been working on for a long time. So the first thing I would say is that we need to have a distinction in mind because impact and effectiveness are two different things. So very often we look at sanctions as the more they hurt, the more they achieve, but it's not necessarily the same. Johan Galtung already wrote about this naive theory of sanctions in the 60s, say, listen, it's not necessarily the case. If you look at a lot of examples in history, that the more you hurt the country, the more they fight back. So ask the Ukrainians today, ask the Russian Federation after the invasion of Germany, look at the history of Stalingrad. So there is the resilience and the strength you can actually have when you're really hurt can be actually counterintuitively leading to the conclusion sometimes you do not want sanctions to hurt because if they overdo it, then they create a problem that you don't have otherwise. So that's the starting point. So impact, which is the effect on the economy or the effect on the individuals, is not necessarily the same thing that the effectiveness. We have examples in history where we designed on purpose sanctions that were supposed to be light. The whole story, the whole sanctions narrative of today, what we call the targeted sanctions, came out of a reasoning saying, listen, we do not have to hurt. Because if you hurt everyone, you create exactly the kind of local identity that pushes back that you don't need. It was the case of Iraq in the 90s. It was the case of Haiti. You don't have to hurt the innocent civilians, for instance, because they want them to be on your side. And if you stop selling them milk, they might hate you more than they would hate you before. So the idea of impact is really wrong, connected to the effectiveness. So, for instance, also in the case of Russia, there's the idea of going after everyone, but it's not necessarily better. I'm not saying that it's never better. It really depends. So for sure, these two things are different. Impact is not effectiveness. When we think about the effectiveness, we need to think about what it is that we want to achieve. In my work, I try to disaggregate a little bit the purposes of sanctions. So sanctions, in the way you said, is the behavioral change. So Russia has to do X, Y, and Z. Iran has to do X, Y, and Z. Or Venezuela has to do X, Y, and Z for sanctions to work. In reality, the behavioral change is only one component, one thing the sanctions can contribute to achieve, not necessarily determined by themselves. One important thing for the behavioral change is that the other party has to be able to do something, a voluntary behavioral change, because they need to voluntarily do what you're asking them to do. I always use the example of Libya, because Libya in the 90s was under sanctions from the UN because of the two suspected officials of the Libyan government. They were suspected for the Lockerbie bombing. And then the UN went to Libya and they said, can you give us these two individuals for trial? Gaddafi said no, and then sanctions were imposed. But as soon as these two people were released, sanctions were removed. So the Gaddafi regime was not in danger by complying. In 2011, what we told Gaddafi was very different. We said, either you leave office and you go to jail, or we're going to help the rebels, so they put you somewhere else. So Gaddafi did not have an option but fighting back. So these are two fundamentally different kind of purposes. So the first is the coercion. So you want them to change the behavior. That means that you need to talk to them. You create a little bit of an economic pressure or a political pressure or a social pressure, but then there is a dialogue. The second one is the constraining purpose. So the constraining purpose is the jail principle. I don't want to change your will. I want to change your capabilities. So you might want to kill people, but if I put you in jail, you are unable to do it, even if you want. So that's the fundamental difference between coercion and constraining. And that's what we very often impose sanctions for. Now, sanctions in Russia are to undermine the military capabilities. We might not change their will to create, if they have a will, to create greater Russia. But if they are unable to use the military instrument, we change their capabilities. And that's what kind of thing that we do with sanctions. So coercion, constraining, and the last part is signaling. Now, very often sanctions are relegated to symbolic instruments if they do not have an impact. But symbols are very important in foreign policy. It's about identity. It's about creating expectations for the future. Very often we impose sanctions not for what's happening today or tomorrow, but what you don't want to happen in 10 years down the line. So signaling is a very important purpose also that sanctions fulfill. So the question is, when do you know when sanctions work? Then I would say, first, think about what it is that sanctions are supposed to be achieving. Are they supposed to coerce? Are they supposed to constrain? Are they supposed to signal? And then look at a number of other things. I will mention only two, because otherwise the story might become too long. But these are things I want to add to the debate. First, things are good or bad according to what you get out of them for the price you pay for it. So sanctions are not bad or good independently from how much you pay for it. And that's the same principle you would apply to a car, to a cell phone. A good cell phone is a good cell phone if you pay the good price for it or a cheaper price. But a good cell phone is not a good buy if you pay 2 billion euros for a cell phone. A glass of water, if you are in the desert, might be way, you know, more expensive, worth the price for it, than a glass of water downtown here in Groningen, where we are at the moment. So what you pay for things is very important compared to what you get. So in the case of sanctions, how much do they cost and what are you getting out of it? Because very often there might be very cheap sanctions, but you're getting something out of it. It's a good investment. If sanctions are creating more problems and you pay a lot for sanctions, then it's a bad idea. So first thing, remember that you need to assess how much do they cost. Second, very important, what are the alternatives? Because you can say sanctions didn't work in 2014. Fine. But what alternative would have worked better at the cheaper price? Because that's the difficult thing. For academics, this is what we call counterfactuals. And it's almost blasphemy. We can't think about this because we are social scientists still. So it's a soft science. It's a science nevertheless, which means that the empirical observation is very important. But policymakers reason a lot in counterfactuals. So the counterfactuals, even if we don't have still developed instruments to measure it, are very much and widely used by the policy, by the decision makers. So again, the question is, that's what Baldwin called the comparative utility of sanctions. So what else could you have done that would have led you to a better result for a cheaper price than sanctions or anything else? And if the answer is nothing, then sanctions did do something in whatever case you're looking at.
All right. Thank you very much. So I think as a concluding question, based on all of this, do you think regarding Russia that the sanctions have been successful, or do you think that we could do still more, or that we should still do more? So based on this discussion, what do you think?
Sure. I think in a nutshell, I think that sanctions in the case of Russia are doing what sanctions are supposed to be doing, which means that they're increasing the price of a military operation. That's what they're designed to. The 10th package is all about going after certain technology and going after circumvention. So that's what also important thing for the first time, both the US and the EU are going after circumvention together. Normally that was something that the US was doing by itself. Now also the EU, because of course it's a big world. And if you go after so many products, then it would be very easy to find countries or partners that would re-export these products back to Russia. So you need to close the loopholes. And that's what the European Union and the US are doing. Is this enough? Well, we need to do more. Sanctions will work better if you constantly update the sanction structure to go after these evasion schemes, circumvention, if you learn how the target is adapting, and that's also what you need to be doing. So again, in a nutshell, sanctions are doing what they're supposed to be doing. Are they going to by themselves resolve the crisis? No. Because again, as I said before, sanctions is a part of a bigger story. So you need to have it's going to be a diplomatic solution that comes out of the battlefield. So at least you have three instruments, the sanctions, military instrument, and diplomacy that work at the same time. And either the three of them work together or they will not. But it's not going to be one only being credited for the entire outcome of the crisis. And certainly sanctions by themselves cannot fix the problem. And one more thing about how sanctions are supposed to be working. One of the things that the European Union and the US have to be doing, and that speaks for the interaction between different foreign policy instruments, is one, on the one hand, as they're doing, going after evasion, but at the same time, we need to extend the alliance, the countries that are actually on board with these crises, and especially finding solutions to solve this crisis. This cannot be done in contraposition to big players like China, India, Brazil. There are a lot of countries that have abstained or voted against in the UN resolution a few days ago. And so we need to be able to talk to these countries and then extend the network and the alliance that is willing to solve the crisis. So in a nutshell, sanctions by themselves will not do much. But if going after evasion is one part of the story, but what you can also do, you can extend the number of actors that are actually imposing sanctions. And this is something that we should be doing more actively in the future.
All right. Thank you very much. I think that concludes our discussion here. Francesco, it was a pleasure to have you. Thank you very much. It was a very nice discussion. And
yes, thank you so much for joining us and for taking the time
thank you
to
very
answer
much.
These questions and explain the concept a little bit more, because I think, as you said, there are some points that are quite elusive and confusing at times. So it's nice to have a contextualization of everything.
Perfect. Thank you very much, and thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening, and see you in the next one.